DBHDD is reminding Georgians to ask their doctor about alternatives to opioid pain medication. Alternatives such as over-the-counter medications and physical therapy can be used to manage pain. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We've got a very, I think, important and illuminating special edition of Political Rewind today. We're going to be talking with the author of a book about how manufacturing jobs in this country dried up, the consequences of what that meant, and we'll introduce her in just a moment. But before we do, I want to give you a quick update on a news story that, of course, we've been following with our panels for the past week or so on the show, and that's this effort by Democrats in the United States Senate to get action on two voting rights bills, which have now been combined into one measure. Obviously, last week, Senator Sinema and Manchin said they would not do anything to overturn the 60-vote margin needed to pass legislation, nor would they overturn the filibuster that would allow the voting rights bills to pass on a majority vote, which seemed to shut down President Biden's, very, very strong and, fist-pounding speech in Atlanta last week in which he talked about the fact these bills had to be passed. But today, the Senate has taken advantage of a legislative maneuver to open the door for a debate on the two voting rights bills, and Majority Leader Schumer says that debate will take place. They can do it without the 60 votes traditionally or typically needed to do that. So we're going to watch how that debate unfolds. Nevertheless, when the debate ends, Republicans will still be able to block the bill because the vote itself would require 60 senators to join in passing the legislation. So we'll talk about it on the show for the rest of this week, certainly, and keep track of what's happening there. Both Senators Warnock and Senator Ossoff are deeply involved in efforts to get these bills passed and will be part of our conversation throughout the next few days. But let's get to a really important show, I think, today. And I'm going to introduce, Farrah Stockman in just a moment. But before I do, I want to just share with you a very quick personal experience. Most of you know I grew up in Chicago. And my family, from the time I was young, used to drive to New York City with some regularity. We'd get on Interstate 90 and drive east across the country. And one of the most thrilling parts of that drive for me, whether it was going there or coming back, was driving through Gary, Indiana, and seeing the belching fires and smoke from the smokestacks of the steel mills lighting up the horizon. It was thrilling. It was an example of American power of manufacturing at its best. And of course, there came a time when I'd make that drive as an older Chicagoan when there were no steel mills active at all. They had dried up. They had gone away. Gary, Indiana was a town that was dying. And that happened long ago. We saw the same thing happen in Pittsburgh with the steel mills. Well, the steel mills shut down a long, long time ago, but manufacturing jobs subsequently in the decades of the 21st century have disappeared left and right. And that's what we're going to talk about today, the consequences of Americans who lost their jobs and what happened to them moving forward. It's one thing to talk about this from the 50,000-foot level and to say that millions of Americans in manufacturing with unskilled jobs were put out of work when plants moved overseas. But what Farrah Stockman has done in her book, American Made, is to go in and give us a macro view of three workers who worked at the Rexnord ball bearing plant in Indianapolis, Indiana, Shannon, Wally, and John. And we're going to talk about their lives and what happened to them as they went through this traumatic experience. All that said, Farrah Stockman, thank you so much for being here for our conversation today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start, if you don't mind, with a few personal items that you talk about in your book. You're very good in this book about relating your own life to the lives of the workers who you focused on. And if we can, I want to start with the fact that you talk about the experience you had when you were in college and the job you took on to help support your college studies. You worked in a dining hall, right?
Yeah, I worked two or three nights a week in a graduate student dining hall, spooning spaghetti and spaghetti sauce onto people's plates. Yep.
And it occurred to you one day that for you, what, this was temporary. Talk about what happened when you suddenly realized what your life looked like compared to the full-time workers around you.
Well, back when I was in college, I went to an Ivy League school. I felt poor to be there having to work in the dining hall for extra pay. And you're always comparing yourself to people around you. So I'm comparing myself to, you know, kids who didn't have to work in a dining hall, kids who had computers in their rooms. And I had to go and, you know, use a shared computer to write a paper. But in the process of reporting this book, I came to realize the educational privilege that I had to get that education and to who should I really be comparing myself to. Through the course of this book, I learned that only one third of American adults have a college degree, have a BA. Two-thirds of American adults do not have a BA. They either have an associate's degree or they took a couple college classes and then left school, or they never went beyond high school. And so that is the real fault line to me that we never talk about. And we never talk about it because we live in a society that likes to say that, oh, we're a meritocracy, and, you know, the ones who are on top, the ones who make all the decisions are there because they're the... You know, they went to school, they're experts. But the reality is that people who have highly educated people live in a different economic universe than those who didn't go beyond high school. And yet we are the few and they are the many. And a lot of people who make these decisions for the country don't really have anyone in their social circle that didn't graduate high school or that didn't graduate college even. That doesn't, you know, people don't even have an advanced degree, right? And yet they're a tiny minority. So that's what that was one of the big takeaways I got when I was researching this book.
Well, and when you, in your dining hall experience, you say that there was a woman who you knew pretty well, full-timer. You said, I did not understand at the time that a bright yet unspoken line divided us. We undergraduates would be gone in a few years, on our way to becoming ambassadors, perhaps, or tenured professors or journalists. She'd remain in her job if she was lucky. Another cafeteria supervisor lost her job abruptly after a decade of service for sneaking a box of cereal out in her bag, a crime that students committed all the time. You tell us that very early in the book, and you set up, I think, you open the door for us to willingly examine people whose lives are lived differently, certainly than you and I live. I had a summer job in college, working the overnight shift, 9 to 5:30 in the morning, filling grocery orders for the biggest supermarket chain in Chicago. And it was a very tough, demanding, physical job, moving soup cases and heavy grocery supplies onto pallets. And I do remember an experience like yours. One night I was sitting talking to one of my worker friends, an older guy, and he said what you basically realized. He said, just don't give up school. I will be working here next year when you're back in college, sitting in your dorm, studying for an exam. Think about me. And that was really kind of a remarkable thing for him to have said to me. And it reminded me a lot of your experience.
Yeah, for sure.
So
for sure.
Tell us, let's talk about Rexnord. In Indianapolis, Tell us what Rexnord, we know it's a ball bearings manufacturing plant and really one of the finest in the world at the in the days that it was firing on all cylinders, right? Talk about it a bit.
Yeah, so this plant was built in 1959 by a company called Linkbelt, which was really famous. Linkbelt had its roots from it was an old company that got started by a person who invented detachable chains so that farmers could fix their machines in the field by themselves instead of having to take it into a shop. And this was sort of like, you know, the late 1800s, basically, when Linkbelt was formed. And so it was, you know, it was kind of fun to learn how many of the sort of name brand machine companies around today date back from this period of invention. By the 60s, this is the golden age of American manufacturing. Linkbelt has factories all over the country, and it sells its products all over the world. And, I didn't even know what a bearing was when I started this book, but ball bearings, roller bearings, they're a little gadget that's in every machine that moves has one, and it basically reduces friction so that a conveyor belt or a crane or a wheat combine can move without burning up from the friction. And so, they built this plant, and it was a big employer. Linkbelt was a very famous company. If you were a blue-collar worker in Indianapolis, you knew that you would be taken care of. If you got a job at Linkbelt, you knew that they would go through several steps to it before they fired you. You would, if you were an alcoholic, they would get you treatment. If, you know, they had glee clubs and sports teams, they went bowling together. It was a real sense of camaraderie. They had a union hall that represented not just that factory, but a bunch of other factories. And so it was a tribe. It was a real, it was a supportive community. If you were lucky enough to get in there, it wasn't easy to get a job there. You had to know somebody essentially to get a job there. And so, it was really interesting for me to talk to factory workers who had one of the last best jobs that you could get if you hadn't gone beyond high school. So these guys and gals were earning $25 an hour, in some cases with a GED.
So I realized in my enthusiasm about getting to talk to you, I didn't introduce you quite as properly as I should. And one of the things I should say, of course, is that you are a member of the editorial board of the New York Times. But in 2017, working at the New York Times, you were assigned to travel to Indianapolis and do a story about Rexnord. We should also say, although I said it at the very beginning of the show, during your many years at the Boston Globe, you won a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting on what the busing movement in Boston, the tumultuous busing of students in Boston, with the outcomes it led to for many students. Okay, that said, you went out to fulfill an assignment to go see Rexnord. What was the assignment? What were you tasked with doing?
Well, let me actually start with election night of 2016, because that's kind of the roots of this book go back to that, which is, so I spent it on Wellesley's campus, which was Hillary Clinton's alma mater, and I was assigned the task of gathering string for what was to be an historic night of the election of our first female president. And so I'm gathering string all day for this story. We had somebody in her hometown. We had somebody in New York at the Javits Center, where she was expected to give her victory speech. And, you know, obviously the night went how it went. And people were stunned. They were shocked. And it was the experiences of that night that led many, many people to conclude that, there was something that people were missing about what was going on in the country. the fact that so few of these big media personalities saw what was coming, and it was extraordinary. So in the weeks following that, you know, I'm from the Rust Belt. I grew up in Michigan, and I started asking people, why Donald Trump? Why this guy? This is a man who had never served even one single day in government at any level, and he was just elected president of the United States. Why this guy? And I kept hearing, he's going to save my job. He's going to save my factory. He's going to bring the factories back. And, you know, at the time, I had totally missed the shtick that he did at his rallies, where he would say, is there anyone here from Carrier? And Carrier was an Indianapolis plant that was moving to Mexico. They made air conditioners and furnaces. And the Carrier workers in the audience would raise their hands, and he'd say, how many years of seniority did you have there? And they'd say, like, 10 years, you know, 20 years. They'd start calling out their years of seniority. He would say, I'm never going to eat another Oreo cookie. Why? Because the parent company that made Oreos was moving out of Chicago to Mexico. So there were all of these, you know, he basically found this source of valid economic grievance that Democrats had been talking about for years, but that Hillary Clinton was not a credible person to talk about it. Why? Because her husband signed NAFTA. And so after I started sort of digging in, I started realizing how much anger, literal fury there was over NAFTA in some of these places. And so anyway, I started to think, I wanted to sort of see, like, what does it feel like to have your job move away and be told that you're going to be unemployed because those people over there are going to do it a lot cheaper than you. So I looked for a place, and I chose, I initially looked at a factory in Philadelphia, and then I decided to follow Rex Nord in Indianapolis because Trump tweeted about this factory, and he said, no more, you know, Rex Nord is viciously firing these 300 workers, no more. And, you know, what's going to happen there? He sort of had this very public feud with the union leader of that plant over whether he was exaggerating his ability to save jobs and that sort of thing. And so anyway, it was a ripe topic, and I started flying to Indianapolis, and I followed them as the factory closed down around them for about 7 months. And then I decided to follow them for all 4 years, pretty much, in the Trump administration.
Yeah, I have to say that obviously there are a lot of journalists, political scientists, and others who have tried to explain, to get to the bottom of the Trump phenomenon in 2016, and still to this day, and it's been a mystery. I have to say, because you focus on three individuals, I got a better sense of this than I've ever had before, of just what it was that inflamed workers to want to vote for Donald Trump. And I think that's one of the great successes of your book, and we'll talk more about that as we move forward. I do want to tell you, our senior producer, Natalie Mendenhall, a graduate of Wellesley, was there on that night in 2017,
wow,
or 2016 as well, and went through the same experience you did.
You saw what I saw. I mean, people were melting down. They actually brought in the cardboard cutouts of Donald Trump. They, like, brought those into the press room because people were starting to attack the cutouts.
All right. Let's talk about the people you focus on. And if you don't mind, we'll take them one at a time. One is a woman, a white woman. One is a white man. And the third is an African-American man. They're all in their 40s, as I recall.
Yeah.
And they've all been working at Rex Nord. Tell us a little bit about the story of Shannon.
Yeah. So Shannon was a single mom who had worked her way up from a janitor at this plant, all the way up to a heat treat operator, which was one of the most dangerous and highly skilled positions on the factory floor. She made a lot of money in overtime. And her story was fascinating because she had been an abused woman. She had been with a very abusive guy, and she knew that in order to escape him, she had to get a job. And so she went and begged her uncle to get her on at Rexnord, which was Link Belt at the time. And he got her that job. And so you can sort of see what that job meant to her when you go back and look at, like, it meant freedom from an abusive guy. And that job gave her not only the money, but the confidence to leave him and strike out on her own and be a breadwinner. And when she told me her story of how she learned the job of being a heat treat operator, it was also extraordinary. She talked about how hard they tried to get her fired because she was the first woman ever to do that job. They, you know, the first night or day she was training, they told her, like, you know, push this button, turn this valve, open this door. She does it, and boom, fireball leaps out. And she screams, and they are all laughing. And it was like, heat treat is not for a woman, one of them said. So it was just, you know, you could say it's hazing, you could say it's major gender discrimination, but, you know, she had been abused her whole life, one way or another. She had been sexually abused by her stepfather when she was a kid. And then, you know, like, it's just her whole life was a litany of various forms of this. And so, you know, she's like, oh, hell no. You're not chasing me from this job. I make $25 an hour here. Like, I started off making $7 as a janitor. You're not chasing me away. So, you know, I just came to see her story as this sort of, she had a lot of spunk, and she did anything she could to fit in, whether it was, you know, laughing about some, you know, lewd joke, or flattering the oldest man in the department who knew everything about all the furnaces and ultimately took her under his wing and taught her everything. And so I really, the story of Shannon, she was the first character I really went deep on because I wrote a piece in the New York Times about her after following her for 7 months and really watching her agonize over whether she should train the Mexican guy who was replacing her or whether she should refuse because the union didn't want them to train. The union thought if none of us train the Mexicans, then they can't move. And
yeah,
so
that becomes go ahead, yeah. Finish that thought.
Oh, so I just really watched her agonize over that and came to really see, like, you know, who she was as a person through that experience.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I do think that step that we'll talk about a bit later about, you know, the heartbreak of having to train the Mexican replacements you go into in great detail. And it is heartbreaking. But I do want to point out that you say in the book that you came to see Shannon as a blue collar feminist in the tradition of Dolly Parton, which I thought was wonderful. But here's another thing you accomplish with your book. You take the threads of the personal stories of these three and are able to extend them to much larger sociological phenomena that we're dealing with right now. In Shannon's case, it's single women in the workplace. And you go into some depth talking about what it's like to be a single woman in the workplace and how difficult it is to take that on. Tell us a little about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, so she's juggling childcare. Her kids were grown pretty much almost by this point. Her daughter was a senior in high school wanting to go to college. And her son had a disabled granddaughter that she was sort of largely responsible for caring for. And so I really had to understand that. Sorry, just trying to plug in my computer here so it doesn't die. I really had to understand that Shannon faced some very specific challenges that her male counterparts didn't. Like, I also came to see that for women like Shannon, the feminist movement wasn't about, like, Hillary Clinton becoming president. It was about being able to operate a machine on the factory floor, being able to get paid overtime and get seniority. And it was a totally different, it was kind of a different experience than the feminist conversations that you know, lean in and how do you negotiate salaries like a man? Well, you know, for these blue collar women, if you're in a union job, you know, it's just like seniority. Do you get to pick? Do you get to write your name on the bid sheet and get the job that you deserve? And so it was very eye-opening to me.
Wally is the second of the three people you introduce us to. Wally's an African-American man whose family's from rural Georgia. And you tell us that Wally is filled with Wally-isms, which are kind of folk wisdom that he's gained from his experiences in Georgia. What's an example of a Wally-ism?
Oh, my gosh. You catch more flies with honey than vinegar. He had so many funny sayings.
Wally had, you point out to us that Wally, another $25 an hour worker, which was a fortunate position to have, you point out to us that well into the 20th century, black men were largely barred from operating machines. And that the jobs they could find were as ditch diggers, shoe shiners, waiters, chauffeurs, and that the largest employer of black men in the 20th century was the Pullman Company, which hired former slaves to cater to the needs of wealthy passengers. So that's an environment out of which Wally's story can be told.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the heartbreaking facts that I learned from historians was that enslaved men actually had more skills in many cases than their descendants, because if they were a master carpenter, then that benefited their master, right? That benefited their owner. But after emancipation, they're just another laborer out there who's competing with white men for jobs. And in the South, it was a little different. There were still a lot of people with this knowledge, but in the North, there was so much discrimination when it came to getting a union job at a factory that, you know, they were working in some of these mills. I found evidence of black men working at Linkfelt. But it was always the worst jobs, the lowest jobs, the most menial jobs. And Wally got his job because of his uncle as well, who moved up and got a job at Linkfelt in the 60s. But it was like an NAAC pressure campaign that caused Wally's uncle to be able to get that job. And he had to pass a million tests. They initially told him there's no job for you, all of this stuff. And finally they hire him. And what do they assign him to do? Be a janitor. And Wally's uncle, and you know, early 60s, Wally's uncle goes to the union and says, I've been to technical school. Do you think I can't operate a machine? And the union steward looks at him and says, we know you can operate a machine. Of course you can. It's just that there's only so many jobs in this building. And if you get one, that means that's one less job for my son or his nephew. And so it was just, it's one less job for one of us. And so it was just a real eye-opener to see that jobs and how they're divvied up and how they're handed out, essentially, it's tribal in a lot of ways. And so for black people like Wally's family, the Civil Rights Act, when that passed, that was the day that Wally's uncle went and said, I want to operate a machine And that's what civil rights was to him, being able to get a grinder, to be able to be on the floor. He earned twice as much money throughout his life because of that act that allowed him to go and operate a grinder.
I got to get to a break, but we want to point out that for a while, the only way Wally could earn a living was dealing drugs. He was arrested for that. He spent time, did time for it. And you say at one point in the book, the biggest lesson I took from Wally's story was how thin and fickle the line between citizen and criminal can be, and how frequently it has to do with how people earn their daily bread. Another really fascinating observation from you. Let's do this. We got to get to a break. We'll come back. We'll meet John, who is the union organizer of the three of them. But then we're going to have to talk about the fact that despite the differences that separated them and how they ended up at Rexnord, they all ended up in the same boat, out of work because of outsourcing. We'll talk about that and more with Ferris Stockman after these messages. My guest on today's Political Rewind is Ferris Stockman, New York Times journalist, whose book American Made is the story of how the collapse of manufacturing jobs in the United States made a deep, deep impact on who we are as a country and on the individuals that she documents in her book, what it did to their lives. There's so much in this book that we could get to, Farah, but we're going to try to focus with the time we have left and tell a big part of what happened to these three. The third character, for real person you introduce us to, is John, who you point out hailed from a long line of union men. And in John's case, he really has a union background. His grandfather, great-grandfather, members of the United Mine Workers Union, which fought some of the most ferocious battles with mine companies in the early part of the late 19th century and early part of the 20th century. So he was a dyed-in-the-wool union guy, right?
Absolutely. And he was the vice president of the union. And so when Rexnord announced this plant is going to close, John goes around the whole plant saying, nobody trains. Don't train. If you train one of your replacements, you're no better than a scab. And so it was I was very interested to follow John. This was actually his second plant closing that he'd gone through. Yeah. 10 years earlier, he'd gone bankrupt after a different plant he worked at, actually moved to Alabama. So it's not just moving overseas, it's moving to places that didn't have unions.
He became vice president of the union. He fought to get that job because he felt he was more fierce in his defense of the workers at Rexnord. And that also proved to be the case when the company wanted them to train the Mexican workers who would take over these jobs. And he rallied people around him, although he still, to some extent, was an outlier in some of his most militant positions with the company, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the other union leaders were kind of, they'd been there a really long time, and they sort of engaged in a lot of horse trading with the bosses. There was a sense of a clique that was running things, and John was an outsider, for sure.
There's a fascinating story that you tell about John later in the book. You get to know him pretty well. But early in the book, you say that you and Shannon had things in common. You were both mothers. Wally and you were both descendants of slaves. But John's identity was harder for you to grasp because he's the first person you'd ever known who described himself as a hillbilly, which he thought of as a badge of honor and a slur. And he said, you have to have a little hillbilly in you to understand it. He said that one of his favorite movies was Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou, which makes sense. But later in the book, you realize that you've gone to his house and he has a Confederate flag in his garage, which launches the two of you into a deep, deep conversation about race, the meaning of that flag to John and to you. It's one of the really interesting, it's a little, aside from the fact that the plant closed, but it's a fascinating story, Farah.
Yeah, it was definitely the hardest chapter to write. Because on the one hand, John, being a union guy, he works side by side with Black people in every factory he's ever worked in. He fights for their jobs because they are his union brothers and sisters. And even at the next job he gets, he's working at a hospital. His best friend there is a Black guy who started around the same time as him, and they go motorcycle riding together, they go squirrel hunting together. And so, like, it was really, John was a guy who had far more contacts and real meaningful relationships with Black people than most of the white guys that I know here in Boston who seem liberal. And yet, this Confederate flag just floored me. Like, what is that? Why is that there?
So let's talk about what happens when Rexnord announces the plant is going to shut down. It sends all three of your characters, like the rest of the people in the plant, just spinning out of orbit. You open the book but with a conversation among some of the workers, asking each other, what do you want to do next? And the reality is, although they offer some kind of vague ideas, as they're talking about the plant that hasn't yet closed, nobody really knows what they're going to do next, including your three characters. Well, Wally does. Wally wants to have a barbecue
Wally
place.
Wally did. Wally had a dream. Yeah, Wally had a dream. He wanted to open a barbecue place. And I knew that's one of the reasons I followed him, is because I wanted to see if he actually did it. He was a go-getter who had this entrepreneurial dream and this belief that he could do it.
But Shannon, I think, is out of work for like a year and a half, although there's a fascinating story about what happens to her, but it's a year and a half before she finally gets work again. John feels like his whole family is living under a curse, and for a while he's not sure how he is going to break that curse. He does end up finding work. He's in a hospital, which he realizes is a much smarter place for him to be than in, say, a manufacturing plant, right?
Yeah, there's this moment where he's deciding, do I become a steel worker again? Because there was a chance that he could get on at a plant that would have made him a steel worker again, and he would have gotten, you know, a similar salary. But he decides, no, I'm not going to go through this again. He's looking at the wealthy doctors walking through the halls, and he says, I want to be in their boat. Whatever, you know, I don't see somebody coming in from the outside and getting rid of this hospital. I don't see the wealthy doctors letting that happen. So I want to be with them.
And of course, he's at the hospital when COVID hits, as if you haven't already covered enough ground in your book.
My God.
As you're trying to come to the end of the book, suddenly the coronavirus shuts everything down. Yes.
Right. I had written a whole book and turned an entire draft, and then my publisher was like, you got to add COVID. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's do this. Let's get to our final break of the show. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about something I never thought about as deeply as you made me do in this book, in talking about the impact of NAFTA and the World Trade Agreement. And I think that's one of the most interesting things we learn about the impact that those agreements had on American workers. We'll do that when we come back with Farrah Stockman. I'm talking to New York Times journalist Farrah Stockman, whose book American Made takes a very deep, deep look at what happened when much of the American manufacturing economy collapsed, what it meant to the country, and what it meant certainly to the three people who worked at the ball bearing company that shut down and moved to Mexico. I really encourage you to take a look at her book when you have a chance. So Farrah, I spent a lot of time covering the Clinton administration certainly covered Clinton's NAFTA push. He believed in it wholeheartedly. So did obviously a lot of American political leaders. And for many years, it struck me that NAFTA was, of course, an important way for us to become part of a global economy. And that there's some truth to that. But Farah, your book really, really makes clear how the initial NAFTA agreement also devastated so much of the manufacturing economy here, the jobs here, and put the workers that you write about in your book and millions of others out of their jobs. That was one of the biggest takeaways I had from this book, actually. And then the World Trade Agreement obviously contributed to that as well.
Yeah, and I think that the global economy, you know, being part of the global economy is good for the United States, and it did grow the economic pie, but it doesn't mean that everybody was better off. And I think if you go back and look at what Clinton promised NAFTA would do, that it would actually increase the number of good-paying blue-collar jobs, that did not bear out, right? We actually lost jobs. And I think probably somewhere around 800,000 jobs is maybe you get different estimates. But then China entering the WTO, which also happened because of Clinton, that is 32 millions of jobs. And you know, in the aggregate, you can say, well, and you know, we live in a big country, and you average out everybody's salary, and it doesn't seem so impactful. But when you zero in on the places that depended on one or two factories that were making these things, and all of a sudden it's gone, you know, that was the carnage that Trump was talking about, and most unless you lived in one of those places, you didn't know what you didn't understand. So I definitely learned. It was eye-opening to me to hear them talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's clearly what I had in mind when I said at the top of the show that your book gave me an understanding of the rise of Trump and the phenomenon around Trump much in a much fuller way than I'd ever thought about it before. And suddenly, you know, as you look at the story of Shannon and John, who voted for Trump in 2016, Wally voted for Hillary Clinton, but you can understand the rage that led them to take the side of a guy who made promises that in most cases for them, he certainly was not able to keep. But the rage is understandable based on your stories.
Right. If you think about John, he had been a Democrat. He had been from a long line of Democrats. These were union people. They were John used to tell his kids, if a Democrat's in office, old dad's got a job. If a Democrat's out, if a Republican's in there, old dad's out of work. And then, his factories, the factories start closing and moving away. And he really reevaluates. He had been such a supporter of Bill Clinton, thought of Bill Clinton as, you know, fighting for the little guy. And that's what the Democrats stood for. And then after, you know, the factories start closing down, he totally has this change of heart. He votes for Obama in 2008 because Obama had promised to renegotiate NAFTA. And then when it didn't happen, he stops thinking of himself as a Democrat. But he still can't get excited about anybody that Republicans are putting up. Like Mitt Romney was a corporate guy, right? John's not interested in that. John's a militant union guy. And then along comes Donald Trump, who's throwing all this red meat about factories closing. Stuff that Democrats used to say, and frankly, stuff that Bernie Sanders was also saying. So this union actually endorsed Bernie Sanders. And when Sanders didn't win the nomination, a lot of them voted for Trump.
You know, it's interesting to me to think about the 92 election, the presidential race that Bill Clinton won over George H.W. Bush, with the help of Ross Perot, who siphoned off votes from, we most likely, from George H.W. Right. Bush. But it was Ross Perot who talked about NAFTA being a giant sucking sound that was going to destroy jobs. And he was treated with less than, say, full respect, partly because he was a character beyond that, but his predictions about NAFTA bore some fruit.
Sure. And I think we should just take a step back and say, like, these people were promised lots more jobs, right? They didn't get that didn't happen. And yet, because the country is being run by people who aren't in the same situation as them, right? Nobody knows. Nobody thinks about it. And so they weren't even compensated for their losses. And I think there was a valid economic grievance there that causes people to then say, build that wall or put tariffs on those goods. They were dying for that. They were waiting for that. And it was an unthinkable thing to do, because for 30 years, any president in the White House was, whatever they promised on the campaign trail when they got into office, they actually supported free trade. None of them dared to put the brakes on it, because it's good for American companies.
Yeah, yeah. So we know that in the 2020 election, you tell us that John voted again for Donald Trump, despite the fact that he had lost his job, and it was not, Trump didn't save him the way he thought Trump would. But Shannon takes a completely different turn, and her turn is really interesting. Tell us just a little bit about what happened to Shannon in 2020.
Yeah, so I kind of came to think of them as the true bellwethers of American public opinion, because, they'd get upset about Trump like kids in cages at the border. That angered them. And then I said, if Shannon's angry about that, he's going to have to backtrack. And sure enough, he does. But by the time the beginning of 2020, Shannon is thinking things are going pretty well. The economy's pretty going well. She has a job. Even her son has a job. And so she is pretty happy with Trump. And then COVID hits. She loses her factory job. Her daughter's by this time now a nurse. And she starts getting scared of COVID. She sees Trump making fun of people wearing masks. She starts to see him as a bully. And then a union organizer comes to her and says, let's start protesting Trump at these rallies. She doesn't have anything to do. And so she goes and she goes in the course of maybe 3 or 4 months, she completely changes to being a very passionate pro-Biden, which was something that had never been possible. Even the
beginning, she goes.
She said, "I'm voting for Harris, not Biden." At first, and then by the end, she's praying for Biden. It was such an interesting thing to watch.
She goes to her first rally of Trump rally in Des Moines. She gets chills when she sees Air Force One land. I get that. But then she said that she learned about Trump from her friend, from Mike, the guy who got her into these protests, that Trump had bragged about being able to shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose supporters. She said, I must really have been blind. And even John, although he voted for Trump, when he starts hearing after the insurrection and starts thinking about Trump talking about the fake election, even he says, what the F are you doing, you idiot? Shut up. It's over. Interesting for him, too.
Why are you a crybaby, right? Why, don't be crying about losing the election. That's why we have elections. So, to me, these are the middle. These are sort of they're not. Yes, QAnon is out there. But at the time I was following these people, they weren't crazy QAnon followers.
So we're down to about the last couple minutes, Farah. But where do these? I mean, you talk about three very specific people, but there are millions of Americans who lost their jobs and were displaced and weren't sure where to go next, job retraining and all that, worked for some, not for others. Just in the broadest way possible, where do we stand today on the reemployment of all the people who lost their manufacturing jobs? And oh, by the way, you have about 35 seconds to sum that up.
Look, I think things are looking up. Wages are rising. Joe Biden is the most pro-union president we have ever had. And the renegotiation of NAFTA, which was done with cooperation between Democrats and Trump's trade rep, that is going to change the game. So I actually do think that we are we're getting somewhere, and we're starting to pay attention to ordinary people and what matters to them. Globalization is only going to work for America if it works for the working class, and we have to figure out how to get there. And I actually think we're making progress in ways that that we don't often see in the newspaper.
Ferris Stockman, I really appreciate your taking the time to join us for the show today. Your book, American Made, is a fascinating look at American life through the eyes of three people who struggled, had some triumphs, had tragedies and heartbreaks. And you told me certainly a lot about the country I live in today. So thank you so much for being here for Political Rewind today. It was a pleasure to talk to you. That's
Thanks
it.
So much
we're
for having
out of
me.
Time. Yeah, we're out of time for today's show. Of course, we're back again with a new show tomorrow. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nigut. Please take care, stay healthy, wear a mask. Omicron is out there and it's looking for us. And if you haven't got your booster shot by now, please go get it. I'll see you all tomorrow.